This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Ulas Doğa Eralp, a professor at American University's School of International Service. Hello, Doğa, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David, for having me. It's great and a pleasure to be on Ahval podcast.
You're welcome. We are speaking on Tuesday, July 21st, just as German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas arrives in Athens to meet with top Greek officials and lay out Germany's plan for its period as president of the European Union Council. The first order of business appears to be dealing with Turkey, which has, in the past 18 months, launched a handful of drilling operations in the waters off of Cyprus, drilling operations that the EU and Cyprus see as illegal, and has detailed plans to begin drilling near Greece's largest island, Crete, in an area Turkey claims as part of its maritime borders deal with Libya's Tripoli-based government signed late last year. This, combined with the refugee issue, combined with Turkish aggressions in the Aegean Sea and regular Turkish violations of Greek airspace, has put tensions between Athens and Ankara as high as maybe they've been in decades. And Athens has said that any Turkish drilling near Crete could spur a military response. Turkey, of course, remains a member of NATO, as is Greece, and remains an EU candidate country and a key EU trade partner. Germany has said it is committed to de-escalation and recently organized back-channel talks between Turkish and Greek officials. Doğa, you teach conflict resolution. How might the EU encourage de-escalation here? Before we get to the two main actors, Turkey and Greece, and what they might do, how might an external actor, namely the EU, move these two sides away from aggression and toward the negotiating table?
Well, I think that's a great question to start our conversation with, because one of my earliest academic studies actually have been on exploring the role of European Union as a mediator. And by then, that was in 2004, that was the case of the reunification talks in the island of Cyprus, and whether you could have played a role in bringing the two parties together. And I will not necessarily change my conclusion from what I said about 16 years ago. No, EU cannot play the role of a mediator, because EU is already an interested secondary party, and it has been vis-a-vis the Turkish-Greek relations since the failure of the reunification process in the island of Cyprus in 2004. What it could do, and that's what the Germans could play, a constructive role as an interested secondary party. But Turkey, to start with, would not necessarily accept that role and Germany's, let's say, initiative in that sense. Vis-a-vis looking into the portfolio of other third-party actors who could actually play a constructive role, then we need to look back now a little bit earlier to 1996, the Imea-Kardak crisis at the time, and the type of role, constructive role, played by the United States under the auspices of the NATO, where both countries are members. So the way we look into the EU initiative today from the perspective of a conflict resolution opportunity, I think what needs to be done is a realistic calculation of to what extent such an initiative could actually play a role in bringing the parties together. So what Germany could do, actually, Germany could reach out, and obviously this could have been much easier if there hadn't been a Trump administration in Washington across the transatlantic and pressure Turkey to ease a little bit off on Eastern Mediterranean. Yet what we see when we look at the Trump administration's reactions in Turkey's maneuvers in Eastern Mediterranean, actually they do quite the opposite. They actually see it as an opportunity for the U.S. to reposition its forces in the Eastern Mediterranean, and seeing Turkey's encroachment in Eastern Mediterranean to ward off Russians. So that by itself is quite destructive. So obviously at this moment, it looks like the German initiative is all we got.
That's interesting. So your view made in that 2004 paper and again today is that the EU cannot play this mediating role, mainly because it's potentially biased, mainly because Greece is an EU member. And so the logical...
So is Cyprus.
So the logical conclusion after that is that the world superpower, the United States, could play this mediating role. But the thing is, as you mentioned, as you suggest, the Trump administration is of course, the Trump administration, which has been friendly to Erdogan, number one. But also right now it's dealing with this massive pandemic, troubled economy, massive protest movement, and, of course, the looming presidential election. So it seems like you're basically saying that there's not much hope anytime soon of an external mediator stepping in.
And this especially is quite tragic when the United States administration takes a rather minimalist approach vis-a-vis commitment to NATO. Just as recent as last week, the Trump administration voiced that U.S. will not be leaving NATO at any time soon. So that's obviously not something one would expect from the U.S. leadership in NATO. And for that matter, unless... like you have mentioned in your earlier question about a possibility of a military confrontation off the coast of the island of Crete between Greece and Turkey, we would not see any meaningful initiative by the NATO to bring the two parties together. And you also need to keep in mind, the French are quite upset at it too, because they also see Turkey's encroachment on the territorial waters of Libya as an encroachment of the French area
oil,
of
oil interests, yes.
And that strategic and political interest in the North African region. So for that matter, they also withdrew from, at the time, an ongoing NATO naval drill in Mediterranean. So for that matter, again, NATO, which could have been the perfect actor, is actually suffering from this whole fallout from the Turkish hard power in Eastern Mediterranean.
Wait, just to be clear about something you just said, you think that if there was to be some sort of military confrontation between Greece and Turkey, or perhaps a near confrontation, or if some sort of conflict were to begin, you think that there would not be a NATO response?
There would be a NATO response, but for that, we need to get to the point we got in 1996. Where basically two armies were launching their sub-aquatic commandos and SAT commandos and parachuting paratroopers on the islands. I hope we don't get to that point.
You're saying until we get to that point, there probably won't be any NATO response.
There will not be any intervention up until then.
Okay. The second key issue to be discussed between Germany's Haas and Greek officials today is refugees, specifically the viability of the 2016 Turkey-EU refugee deal, which basically saw the EU promise Turkey 6 billion euros to help Ankara care for the 4 million or so Syrian refugees in Turkey and put a curb on Aegean crossings from Turkey to Greece. Turkey had largely stopped this flow until earlier this year when Ankara followed through on President Erdogan's long-standing threat to, quote, open the gates to Europe and encouraged tens of thousands of refugees in Turkey to head for Greece as a way to pressure Europe into providing greater funding for the refugees already in Turkey or to come to Turkey's aid in Syria's Idlib province, where some 2 million displaced people are still today living in ad hoc camps along Turkey's border. Many accused Turkey of weaponizing refugees, but Greece and the EU did not emerge cleanly from that episode thanks to significant clashes along the Greek border and Greek security forces challenging and shooting at migrant vessels in the Aegean. London-based research firm concluded it was highly probable that Greek security forces shot and killed a 22-year-old from Aleppo in March as he joined thousands of migrants seeking to cross the border. The EU now seems to have accepted that Greece is bearing too great a burden. So it has significantly expanded Frontex, the EU border control agency, basically militarized its migrant response. How do you see all this, Doha? Who's more to blame for the chaos along the border earlier this year? And how might the EU take some of the burden off of Turkey, which is hosting so many refugees still, and Greece, which has been described as Europe's shield?
Well, I think this whole question on the future of refugees in Eastern Mediterranean is quite complicated, because when we look into, again, the role of Germany, we need to take into consideration the problematic history between Germany and Greece that dates back all the way to Second World War, and again, later, quite recently, in the recent economic crisis and the type of conditionalities that's been imposed on the already crumbling Greek economy by the Germans. So obviously the new government, the Mitsotakis government in Greece, had to openly call out to Germany, saying Greece is no longer that Greece of the economic crisis, and they no longer are willing to make that many concessions in return for a significant chunk of economic aid from Germany, not only obviously to kind of curb up the negative fallout from the pandemic, but also from the fallout from the lack of tourism income, and also how they have to deal with this refugee issue. And when you look into those videos, really sad videos of Greek ultranationalists, Greek fascists, welcoming, quote-unquote, the Syrian refugees that arrived to the island of Chios with crosses and saying, go back to where you come from, Germany, again, has to bring in such a significant chunk of economic aid to Greece that the concerns of the Greek islanders, especially those of those extreme right-wingers, be met, and they, for that matter, be able to contain this right-wing backlash against the refugees. And no wonder then certain rogue elements within the Greek security structures end up shooting at these refugees, because they, like you mentioned, see themselves as guarding the gates of Europe against the invading hordes of Islamic barbarians, quote unquote. And Erdogan, being the cunning politician for decades now, is very much aware of this division and divisiveness within the European Union, and basically leveraging that divisiveness to his own benefit. And back in March, when he actually threatened Europe to open the gate so these tens of thousands of refugees would start flooding EU, he knew...
Well, not even threatened him, he actually did it. But yeah, sorry, please go on.
Yeah, and that's the cruelty of it, isn't it? He well knew that Greece would not open the borders. Everybody knew that. But again, it's not really the act itself, but it's, again, the impact it creates within the European public opinion against Turkey and refugees and whatnot. And since he's such a master of creating polarization and building of political clout out of polarization, Erdogan again used this kind of confrontational language to his own benefit. And for that matter, when we look back and now actually look this week how Germany could kind of respond to Greeks' concerns against this impending refugee flow into Greece, the best they could do is provide unconditional economic aid to the already flailing Greek economy. When you look into the recent numbers of tourist arrivals, if I'm not mistaken, you may need to check that number, it's only 12% of what it was last year. Last year, this time, I was vacationing in the island of Corfu. Let me tell you this, I'm now in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, the country has to deal with such uncertainties. And as you are very well aware, when countries go through such periods of economic downturn, it's rather to the advantage of the politicians to further scratch the nationalist concerns. And it may also work in favor of the Greek government to push for a little bit more confrontation with Turkey, not only on this refugee issue, but also, like you mentioned earlier, on the encroachments near the territorial waters around the island of Crete.
Well, right. As you suggest in your response, Turkey so far seems to have done pretty much whatever it wants in the Eastern Mediterranean, around Cyprus, in terms of refugees, and gotten away with it. This, of course, is in part because Erdogan holds in his hands this threat of another massive refugee wave, which could upend European politics and, as you say, spur the further rise of the far right. It seems like until this threat is removed, to some extent, the EU's hands are tied. It can't really do much. So short of welcoming, opening its doors, opening its borders to 2 or 3 million more refugees, is there anything the EU can do to remove this weapon from Erdogan's arsenal or to reduce its power?
Well, again, you see, the question is not whether and what EU could do against Erdogan, but I think it's, again, more has to do, and this always have been traditionally EU's own weak point, kind of this projecting its own policies to its rivals. But it's rather EU's own weakness vis-a-vis its effectiveness on implementing its policies. It has to get its act together and put strict ordinance on its member states on the type of quota that each member state should accept, how many refugees and whatnot, and be able to govern as more of a political entity, which obviously, as of now, is quite an elusive goal, isn't it?
Well, right, but the EU has tried this, right? And it hasn't. It mostly hasn't worked.
Yeah, and that's why, right, the best next thing, best alternative to the existing or non-existing EU policy vis-a-vis refugees is Germany pulling out more money off of its coffers or the European Central Bank in Frankfurt and provide direct support to the running of these refugee camps and look for different ways of integrating these people into the European society as they, to be honest, quite successfully managed in Germany. But obviously, there's no such appetite in Greece. And again, going back to the Turkey question, Erdogan government feels that it's actually, and honestly, I do think they believe in that, they're doing a great favor to EU by keeping these folks in Turkey. And for that matter, I think they're quite okay with Germany's silence vis-a-vis Turkey's policies in Syria, because Erdogan is quite, again, straightforward about it. Like, oh, you know what? I'm going to put these 2 million folks in that territory controlled in Idlib, and they're not going to bother you. So for that matter, you better remain silent vis-a-vis my policies in Eastern Mediterranean, in Libya, in Syria, and obviously with this whole Eastern Mediterranean encroachment. And that's why I would argue there are certain members within the European Union who are silently okay and happy about Turkey is spreading its wings in Eastern Mediterranean. That's why so far we hadn't really seen any meaningful action against Turkey, aside from obviously a few MEPs voicing their concerns in European Parliament, calling for the immediate cessation of talks, negotiation with Turkey for EU accession, which obviously is a non-starter because there really is no negotiation. So they're at a position of null, let's say, policy. So for that matter, again, EU does not have much to offer to Turkey. But if they play and get their act together, maybe this time under German leadership, which obviously would also have to go through a significant change with the retirement of Frau Merkel in a few months, if I'm not mistaken, then they again need to reevaluate their positions, which again is quite ambivalent.
Mm. Another issue between Turkey and Greece is Hagia Sophia, which was built by the Greek-speaking Byzantines in 537 as a cathedral and was an engineering marvel and the world's largest building at the time. With the Ottoman conquest of 1453, it was converted into a mosque, and then nearly 5 centuries later, it was converted to a museum under Atatürk's purportedly secular Republic of Turkey. Last week, Erdogan turned the iconic UNESCO heritage structure back into a mosque and set the date for Hagia Sophia's reopening prayer event for this Friday, July 24, which is the anniversary of the 1923 signing of the Treaty of Lausanne, which nailed down the Turkish and Greek borders we have today. Erdogan has often lamented that Lauzan handed Greece many Aegean islands that should be Turkey's. So this date setting seems to highlight that. Greece, of course, views these Aegean islands as part of its sovereign identity, and Hagia Sophia still holds a special place in the hearts of Orthodox Christians, particularly in Greece. So, though, I wonder how has this Hagia Sophia reconversion further complicated matters between Turkey and Greece? And is there maybe some positive way this might play out, or will it inevitably only make matters worse?
So I think first we need to set the record straight. Lausanne is actually a multilateral agreement. So that binds not only Greece and Turkey, but all other signatories that had set up the modern Republic of Turkey's boundaries. So although it has not been explicitly mentioned in the Lausanne Agreement, Hagia Sophia signifies a critical cultural, let's say, borderline vis-a-vis in the Greek social identity mindset. And for that matter, Atatürk made a great gesture in 1934 and converted Hagia Sophia from a mosque into a museum. And I think that was the best he could have done. And I wish it had stayed that way. So obviously, it was a long-held dream of the Islamists in Turkey to turn Hagia Sophia back into a mosque. But you know, you need to consider that Hagia Sophia was a church, or let's say Orthodox cathedral, much longer than it had been a mosque. And before they had built Hagia Sophia, there was an Apollo temple. And before Apollo temple, there was a Kybele temple in early Byzantium. So that area had always had some sort of religious significance in the history of Istanbul. The question is, did Erdogan really gain anything from converting Hagia Sophia again back into a mosque? I'm not so much convinced on that yet. That quite depends on how the Islamic world, or the Sunni Islamic world, as one that Erdogan aspires to be a leader of, has reacted to this move. And so far, honestly, it hasn't been so. I haven't seen that many eager responses from rest of the quote-unquote Islamic world about this convergence of Hagia Sophia. So again, it's largely a symbolic move, and it's a rather sad move because this is a UNESCO heritage site with so many valuable frescoes and mosaics, which Atatürk had actually so carefully hired archaeologists to unravel and put up on the museum, would now be in danger. So we have to consider the consequence of such a drastic measure vis-a-vis the maintenance of a humanitarian heritage. So, and furthermore, it rightly upset a lot of Greeks because it has a very significant, let's say, critical value to the Greek political mindset. It's that long lost capital of the Greeks with the long lost greatest Greek Orthodox cathedral that ever was. So wherever you go in the world where there is a Greek Orthodox community, we have it right around the corner where I live in Washington, D.C. There's a St. Sophia Cathedral. So there is this kind of very core, integral part Hagia Sophia plays in Greek political mindset. And this further really diverges the two neighbors in the foreseeable future. What could be done? And in the eventual change of power in Turkish politics in a post-Erdogan world, what could be done is maybe allow for the Christians' worship in Hagia Sophia as well. So create an environment where both religions and both faiths could practice their religions. That's the max that could be done. Otherwise, the type of step Erdogan did take would not necessarily allow for reconverting Hagia Sophia into a museum. And that, I believe, for a large extent, is also the responsibility of the Turkish opposition, mainly the People's Republican Party, that they did not really do a good job in defending the secular values of Atatürk's Republic against Erdogan's Islamist politics. And even in the eventual change of government, I don't think they'd be daring to turn Ayasofya back into a museum. And that's really the tragedy of Turkish politics.
And right, because it's also kind of a symbol of nationalism.
Absolutely. And, you know, like when I look into the Turkish nationalist movement parties, leaders, Bahçeli's statement today in the parliament, how he says, oh, the souls of Fatih Sultan Mehmet, you know, the conqueror, and his professor Akşemseddin's souls would be in the Ayasofya mosque's Friday prayer this week. I mean, you know, this type of cheap imagery would be something you would see in 1970s. There's this famous actor called Cüneyt Arkın. He would play in these awful Turkish movies. There you would see this kind of imagery. You know, that's the quality of kind of this like cheap nationalist rhetoric that comes from. And they think it would still sell, but my impression is young people do not really care much about this because people really don't have much spent neither today nor tomorrow. So this actually is a rather tragic and costly move that wouldn't really necessarily bring much to Erdogan. Mm-hmm. And forget Erdogan to Turkey in the long run.
Yeah, you talk about how this reconversion has possibly been received in the Muslim world. This past weekend, an Islamist history professor in Turkey called for the tearing down of the centuries-old Christian frescoes and mosaics in the Ayasofya now that it's a mosque again. This, to me, dovetailed with the broader idea that with the Ayasofya reconversion, along with Turkish government officials taking a stand recently against LGBT people, and perhaps even with Erdogan's Libya intervention in support of the Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups, Erdogan seems to be increasingly moving toward a conservative, anti-Western position, embracing this position more than he had in previous years. The Turkish relations with the West, specifically the United States and Europe, are already quite problematic, as we've discussed before. But I wonder if you see this Ayasofya reconversion possibly opening up further fissures between Islam and the West. You already mentioned how it's problematic to Greeks, but I wonder if there might be an even broader potential impact and if that might be part of Erdogan's objective.
Obviously, that is. And you see its repercussions when I look into the Russian foreign ministry spokesperson's comments on how wrong such a move and had been reconverting Ayasofya into a mosque. You see already the repercussions of such a move. But you also need to take into consideration Turkey has started relying more and more on military in pursuing its kind of confrontational, assertive objectives in its immediate neighborhood. And that, I believe, is making Erdogan weaker vis-a-vis the military. And at the moment, it may seem quite the opposite, but what we see now, we see a more confident military, Turkish military emerging in the not only the planning, but also the implementation of Turkish political objectives in the Eastern Mediterranean. The concept of a blue homeland, right? That kind of summarizes the Turkish political objectives in Eastern Mediterranean, reclaiming the Eastern Mediterranean as the blue homeland, as once was under the Admiral Barbarossa, under the magnificent Suleiman, right, in 16th century, where Turks controlled Eastern Mediterranean, literally this kind of
right, this is sort of an anti-Western foreign policy approach that Turkey has applied.
Exactly. So that, I believe, is also forcing Erdogan to kind of relinquish and kind of revamp his old allegiances of this rather regressive Islamist views, because his water base also is shrinking, right? He's receiving less of an attention from the younger Turks as the economy is going bad. And then he's kind of now started appealing to the mindset of these 60-plus-year-olds who were, like, what, in their mid-40s when they first brought Erdogan into government. But a whole generation changed. And this actually signifies this kind of rhetoric, Erdogan's weakness. And it also points to the rise of Turkish military as, again, a kingmaker in Turkish politics. That's something that's not necessarily be talked as much. You see this vis-a-vis Turkey's politics in Iraq, in northern Iraq, and in Syria against Kurds, right? Against this perceived threat of rise of Kurdish politics in Iraq and Syria, and not so much as was the case in, let's say, 5-10 years ago. Civilian Turkish bureaucracy no longer has much say on the way Turkey creates its politics, but it's rather this like ultra-nationalist, militaristic alliance that calls the shots in Eastern Mediterranean, in North Africa. Now, more so, and that's another area that, you know, you may want to talk to someone else, in Southern Caucasus, this like kind of Turkish military providing support to Turkey's allies in the region, Azerbaijan against Armenia, the Libyan government against Haftar, and again, you have in Syria, it's these little groups fighting against Assad and the Kurds, these different client states that Turkey sees as, especially this ultra-nationalist alliance sees as kind of this, the emergence of some sort of a Turkish power in Eastern Mediterranean. Again, then circling back to your earlier point about whether EU could play a role in bringing parties in Eastern Mediterranean together, I think it's already a long gone conclusion that Turkey does not see EU as a credible platform through which it could negotiate, as the negotiations had stopped a long time ago. And that by itself actually was a significant factor in Erdogan retracting from his democratic or pro-democracy, pro-liberal policies in late 2000s. So we have to see this kind of two-way relationship between EU-Turkey and between Turkey and Greece, that it's not only Turkey, but it's also European Union's reluctance in moving ahead with Turkish candidacy that pushed Turkey to re-embrace this ultra-nationalist politics. And we see the consequences of that today, unfortunately.
Let's close the discussion by returning to where you began, the underlying issue between Turkey and Greece, Cyprus, which Turkey invaded in 1974 to head off an Athens-backed coup. Turkish forces took control of a sizable chunk of the northern part of the island, which today is the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, recognized only by Turkey, while the southern part of the island is, of course, the Republic of Cyprus, an EU member state. Hopes of reaching a resolution to the Cyprus issue have waxed and waned for decades. You mentioned the 2004 failed talks. But with the discovery of significant natural resources in the Eastern Mediterranean and around Cyprus, as we have mentioned, there have been real hopes of a breakthrough on all sides from Cyprus, Turkey, Greece, and the EU, that they would be driven to consensus by the promise of natural gas revenues. But that hasn't happened, as Turkey has felt that Turkish Cypriots have been left out of Cyprus' efforts to profit from the natural gas, and Turkey has taken matters into its own hands, launching several of its own drilling operations, as we've mentioned earlier. There are, of course, other issues to resolving Cyprus, such as demilitarization and the return of Greek Cypriots to their homes in the north, but I wonder if you think this issue, natural gas resources in the area, could still be a spur toward a resolution on Cyprus, or whether it's too late?
I think both parties kind of dream too much, really, David. I mean, we need to take into consideration the times have changed, right? In the US, we are now talking about Green New Deal. The whole, we have much bigger problems as a planet that we need to deal with, right? Climate change. Now it's like, what, 37 Celsius in Washington, D.C. It's super hot. And main reason for that, as everyone knows, is our dependency on fossil fuels. So hydrocarbon resources and its possible leverage by these actors, so many actors, right? There is Israel, there's Egypt, there's Greece, there's Republic of Cyprus, then there's Turkey, then there's Libya, is not...
You could even say Italy and France as well.
Yeah, right? ENI, then like there's the French. It's not going to happen. There are several reasons. A, the global market in the foreseeable future is going to shrink. There is not that much of a market left in the foreseeable 2 decades for hydrocarbon fields. We just tend to forget. They try to have these like risk assessment done vis-a-vis the demand today. But 2 decades from now, right, when you look into the political and military risks involved in making this project a reality, it would take 2 decades, really, let's be honest, for them to really have this pipeline going and distributing. There wouldn't be that much demand left, right? So who are they going to sell this hydrocarbon? Back to Egypt, right? Back to these semi-developed MENA countries so that they could develop their economies. And there isn't really much of a purchasing power in these countries. So I wish for once, these like middle powers in Eastern Mediterranean, instead of looking at into their like, let's say, short to midterm advantages and like their interests, they try to see and grasp a larger perspective on things and stop spending money on these rubbish goals, really, if you ask me. You know, because...
How would that look? What do you mean? How would they act more with the long-term vision in mind?
I mean, if you ask me, I would stop drilling for hydrocarbon. I mean, obviously, I'm not the head of any. This has really the political objectives of making these dreams a reality, surpass the economic, let's say, rationality aspect of these projects. Mm-hmm. It had too much of a political chip that none of the parties are really willing to take a step back. Obviously, what would have worked as maybe 10 years ago in 2008 when Noble Energy, which has recently been, by the way, yesterday acquired by Chevron, $5 billion.
Right. They made the first discovery in the area, yes.
Yeah, and then they later, oh, it's too much of a risk, and they withdrew last year from the project, right? What would have happened if they actually got, everybody could have got together, agreed on a common platform and be able to sell this gas, and that would have been used as for the public benefit of the whole island and Eastern Mediterranean. That did not happen. And as you know, the main reason for that was the Arab Spring and the whole divergence of Turkey, more as an ardent Ikhwan supporter, and the whole sets of revolutions that shook from Libya to Egypt to Syria. And then, you know, we know the rest of the story. So this hydrocarbon drilling lost its, in my view, economic rationality. In a way, just exactly because these actors turned into a political bargaining chip. And again, Erdogan and the ultranationalist military alliance in Turkey knows quite well, as long as they continue sabotaging the possibility of making this a reality, the less rationality of economic, let's say, value of this project would be at hand for the European partners. So that's their policy. They're just going to continue sabotaging these drilling initiatives, and regardless of who really would run the EU, whether it's the German presidency or whoever comes afterwards, it's not going to change the fact. And I think what Turkey hopes within the next decade or so, the appetite of the global energy markets would cease for hydrocarbons, and they would drop this altogether. And that's typical Erdogan policy, unless they provide a chunk of, let's say, interest Turkey on the negotiation table in running this kind of energy platform together.
You're almost turning this whole thing on, you're almost turning this whole thing on its head and saying that the EU should, in a way, just ignore Turkey's aggressions in the Eastern Mediterranean and Crete and around Cyprus, because in a decade or so, when this natural gas is finally able to come to a market, those markets won't see it as very valuable, as very profitable. Is that right?
And also, Russia would not allow for it either. I mean, we tend to forget this. Like there is a huge dependency on Russian natural gas, especially on the side of Germany. So what these
and in Turkey as well.
Yeah, and in Turkey as well. And these what these companies hope to achieve by these companies, I mean those energy companies that had contracted with the Republic of Cyprus, with Israel, with Egypt, and other partners, right? Hope is like they would provide an alternative, let's say, a channel to European countries who receive. But by then, within a decade, the market would be oversaturated and already would be too diversified when you look into the 2030 goals, SDGs that's been set up, and Germany already promised to be carbon neutral.
Okay, but set aside those companies. That's not really the what is Turkey trying to do? What does Turkey want? It sounds like you're saying to some extent Turkey is aware that these resources might not be all that valuable. So what then is Turkey really trying to do in the Eastern Mediterranean and around Cyprus and Crete?
Turkey is trying to sabotage the deal so that they would say, stop sabotaging the deal and come to the negotiation table with us. Let's create a partnership, right? It's like, this bully in the schoolyard, right? He just needs to, he thinks by acting more aggressive or throwing, rocks at kids, he thinks kids would be interested in playing with him.
So you don't think Erdogan really believes that Turkey will be getting natural gas, considerable natural gas revenues anytime in the near future?
He believes, and not only him, right? Ultra-nationalist alliance behind him believes that Turkey has the legal, right in its access to these hydrocarbon resources through its involvement in Cyprus. So they believe in that, regardless of how irrational it may seem. And for that matter, they make their position known by sending these drilling ships with huge Turkish flags painted on their board and whatnot, right? They're saying, we are here. You may not like to see us, but we are here. And without us being in the table with you guys, you're not going to make this a reality. And as we did scare off Noble Energy, we'll also scare off other energy drilling partners. And imagine if in case of an unfortunate military confrontation between Greek and Turkish Navy or even French Navy, which that just last week they had that type of confrontation, who would invest in building of such a pipeline in Eastern Mediterranean with so many high-level political risks? No one. And Erdogan is very well aware of it. And he's like, look, you just need to invite me over the table. But, that's not going to happen. And that's why this whole game that's being played in Eastern Mediterranean, unfortunately, is a lose-lose for everyone. And what I'm hoping for, and obviously if Turkey will have another democracy, free and fair elections in the near future, and eventual change of leadership in Turkey, things would get better because the new government in Turkey would reevaluate its interests and how they pursue their interests, not vis-a-vis confrontation, but vis-a-vis reconciliation. Because you need to take into consideration Turkish economy is also getting a lot of hits, and it's not easy to spend so many billions of dollars each month on the Navy and everything. And we also need to keep that in mind. Everybody's hurting. And we're going to hurt more if this pandemic thing doesn't go. All countries in Eastern Mediterranean are going to hurt more. So, and I think there is going to be soon some sort of, I hope, epiphany within the Turkish political structure that, we could still pursue our interests, but not necessarily via confrontation, but maybe, via understanding whether we could offer certain olive branches and get something in between. And as is, nobody is benefiting. So that's really my only hope, which is not really like that far off, really, because I think Turkish society is also fed up with this nonstop nationalist rhetoric,
So, but it's interesting that you see Turkey's aggressions in the Eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus, and so on, as less about an effort to take advantage of these hydrocarbon resources than simply an assertion of sovereign rights, leading to whatever it may lead to. That's interesting. But I think we should. I think we've gone far enough with our discussion. We could probably continue for another hour. But thank you so much, Doğa Eralp of American University. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, David.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.